The Helly Kasser Jane Show airs Wednesdays, 3 p.m. Eastern. The podcast always available online at HellyKasserJane.com.
It's scary what's going on, and I think there's very little difference between anti-Israel and anti-Semitic. I think that those lines have so blurred that I personally feel unsafe, and I never felt that way before. I wouldn't go to certain cities in Europe right now. I wouldn't feel comfortable. I almost feel like that because a lot of the bashing that's going on is not necessarily done with smart dialogue. There's just mantras being repeated without thought or knowledge.
Ah, candor, so rare these days. But who would expect anything less from film producer Nancy Spielberg? Hi, and welcome to the Helly Kasser Jane Show. I am Helly Kasser Jane. Thank you so much for tuning in. It is 70 years since the liberation of the Nazi death camp, Auschwitz. So much has changed, and yet, how much? Are we doomed to repeat our past? Two untold stories of World War II are the subject of the Helly Kasser Jane Show. When joining me at my table are producer Nancy Spielberg and director Roberta Grossman to talk about their remarkable new film, Above and Beyond. But we begin with the author of the compelling book, 3 Minutes in Poland, Glenn Kurtz. But first, the Helly Kasser Jane Show is brought to you by Audible.com, a leading provider of spoken audio information and entertainment. Get a free audiobook and 30-day trial today by signing up at www.audibletrial.com/The Helly Kasser Jane Show. And remember, The Helly Kasser Jane Show is always available online at HellyKasserJane.com and a host of venues including iHeartRadio, Stitcher.com, Spreaker.com, TuneIn Radio, iTunes, and Blog Talk Radio.
My name is Inga Auerbacher, and I'm a survivor of the Holocaust. The proof is in the artifacts, the stories, pictures, and the more we have, the better the proof becomes.
Visit PledgeNeverAgain.org to help the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum keep this history alive.
I'm very thankful that this museum exists to give proof to the world and for centuries to come, it happened.
3 Minutes in Poland, Discovering a Lost World, was selected as a best book of 2014 by The New Yorker, The Boston Globe, and National Public Radio. The book's author is Glenn Kurtz, a graduate of the New England Conservatory, Tufts University, double degree program, who holds a PhD from Stanford University in German Studies and Comparative Literature, and whose writing has been published in the New York Times, Salon, Southwest Review, and elsewhere. All writers have their journeys, as do all stories. The story of 3 Minutes in Poland begins in 1938, when Glenn's grandparents took a European trip and returned to the predominantly Jewish town of Mr. Kurtz's birth in Poland. Their journey, 1 year before the outbreak of World War II, captured in 3 minutes on 16mm Kodachrome color film. More than 70 years later, the film rediscovered, Glenn set off on a 4-year journey of his own to identify the people captured in his grandfather's haunting images and would meet one of the film's survivors who would introduce him to another and another. Let's talk. Glenn, this truly is a treasure. What a book. What a story. I mean, so let's go back to the beginning. That's what I want to do. I want you to tell us first about your grandparents. It's David and Liza Kurtz?
Lisa Kurtz. In fact, her name was Lena, L-E-N-A, but for some reason that I was never able to learn, my family always called her Lisa. So sometimes the cousins will refer to Aunt Lena, and I don't know who they're talking about at first.
I love it. They were born in the shtetl in, and I'm going to try and say it, Nashelsk?
Well, my grandfather, David, was born in Nashelsk. His mother's family lived there. And my grandmother, Lisa, was born in a different town in eastern Poland called Berezna on the far eastern edge. At the time, it was on the Polish-Ukrainian border. Now it's in the Ukraine.
Okay. And they both emigrated to the United States. Is that where they met?
Yeah, they both came to the U.S. as small children. In fact, despite my sister's very extensive genealogical research, we've never been able to determine precisely when they came. But it was in the 1890s, in the early 1890s. And they were both little children. They came with their families. And so very much grew up American, although they remembered and obviously retained a sense of, you know, having come from the old country.
They married. Tell us a little bit about their life in the United States.
Well, my grandparents married in 1912, and my grandfather left school after the ninth grade and went to work. He ended up in the, what the time was called, the cuff and collar business, because cuffs and collars on men's shirts were detachable and separate. So that's what he first was in business selling, and eventually ended up in the boys' shirt business, and that remained the family business until my father sold it in 1990. So yeah, they married, and obviously he was a very good businessman. He became relatively successful relatively early on. The business, I think, suffered tremendously in the beginning of the Great Depression, but by the middle of the 1930s, they were doing relatively well again.
And well enough to take a ship abroad for a European tour of sorts in 1938, which is what is captured on the film, which you always knew about. You knew about this film, right?
Yeah, I remember seeing it as a kid. And, you know, we would occasionally pull out this huge old screen, which we would put up in the living room. And my father had a projector and we'd watch this film. And it was just, you know, Grandma and Grandpa's vacation film. Nobody ever thought that it had any significance beyond the family. And it wasn't until much, much later that I looked at it again, really for the first time in probably 25 or 30 years, and my heart stopped. I suddenly realized how significant it was.
Whatever made you look at this film to go back to it? Was it like a moment, like a miracle moment? Do you look back at this? Because look at what this journey has become because you went back at it.
Yeah, it's been incredible. And in fact, the kind of crazy thing is, the reason I looked at this film is because I was writing a novel. And the plot of that novel was somebody finds an old home movie and becomes obsessed with identifying the people in the images, in these unknown images. And as a result of writing that novel, I started researching all the things that can go wrong with film as a physical medium, the ways in which it deteriorates. And at some point in the course of learning about, you know, what can happen to old film, I remembered, you know, we have these old movies. I wonder if they still exist or if they've been, you know, just destroyed by time or thrown out. And so I asked my parents, and they had since, you know, retired to Florida and dissolved the house. And so my father didn't even know if they still existed. It took me 3 visits to their house in Florida, digging around in various closets before I actually came up with the box of old films. And then the amazing thing was that the story that I had been writing in the novel turned out to be my life. I became obsessed with the people in these images.
It's a little reverse on, you know, fiction to reality, reality to fiction. Listen to me, this film was not in good shape when you found it. So let's talk about that.
No, it had deteriorated. One of the things that happens with film is, particularly if it's stored in a very humid environment like Florida, is it will shrink. It will lose certain plastic stabilizers that are in the film base. And this film had shrunk so that it was sort of like a hockey puck. It was a single undifferentiated mass of plastic. And it took 4 months of restoration at a film laboratory before it was softened up enough so that it could be unwound. And then it took another couple of months before the images could be actually digitized individually, frame by frame, and then kind of reconstituted as a film.
I love that they could do that. Tell us what's on that film. Give us a picture.
Well, the whole film of this trip is from 1938, the summer of 1938, and it's a trip that my grandparents took to Europe. And they went to England and France and Holland and Belgium and Switzerland and Poland. And there's a title sequence at the very beginning which says, you know, our trip to all of these places, 1938. And the majority of the film is just very typical tourist footage. It's my grandparents waving at the camera, standing in front of this famous building or that famous building, or there they are in the south of France, putting on sunbonnets and things like that. It's just the same as everybody else's home movies of their vacations from, you know, the dawn of time. But then in the middle, there is this sequence, 3 minutes long, and most of those 3 minutes are in color, of a visit to a Polish town, a Polish shtetl. And the tone, somehow, of these images is very distinct from the rest. Instead of my grandparents being at the center of the frame, now it's hundreds of faces of children and people sort of waving at the camera and jumping up and down, trying to get it into the frame. And yeah, it was just suddenly a different film.
Let's talk August 19th. 1938, a year before World War II begins. Your grandparents had left well before the war, we've established. But what was to come? This is what blew me away, Glenn. What's on this film is so the antithesis of what happens later that it knocks your socks off. Happy children smiling. Talk to me. Tell me what you saw. And I know you understand that contrast.
Sure. Well, I mean, and one of the wonderful things about this film is that it is before the war and you don't know what's coming. That is to say, the people in the film don't know what's coming. And I think it's so important in Jewish history and in the history of the Holocaust to understand that these people were not born victims and they were not born to be killed in this horrible way. They were born to live normal lives. And so we have this momentary glimpse into them leading normal lives. I mean, it's a little bit unusual that Americans are visiting and that they have a movie camera, so everybody's very excited. It wasn't a typical day in the town. But nevertheless, yeah, they're happy, they're excited. They're just living in the town, which is their home. But when you watch it now, the thing that's just so powerful about these otherwise very normal, almost prosaic images, what's so powerful is that we know what they don't know. And that is what the future holds for them, which is something of such unimaginable horror that you look at these smiling children and it's just absolutely haunting and chilling to see them so excited. You want to scream to them, run, get out of there.
What to me makes it even more, I don't know, what's the word, bizarre maybe even, is the fact that it is shot in color. And you think World War II and you think black and white, stark images, shadows, grays, right?
Yeah. Well, color film, 16mm Kodachrome color film had been introduced in 1935. And Kodak Company had actually had made a big push to get people to try and adopt movie cameras. It was not as rare as people think it was for American tourists, people who had the resources to travel, to have a movie camera. But still, it wasn't very common. And certainly color film is very unusual. And I think that's one of the things that makes this film just so extraordinary. I think that black and white boundary kind of distances the past to us. And so we can look at these images, of course, of the Holocaust, but especially of before the war, and think, well, that was the black and white world. It's somehow different from our world. But when you see these images in color, you know, you see the colors in people's clothing and the colors of the streets and their flowers and their trees, and it brings it in a way closer into our world, and it feels like there's a continuity there. And that is something I think so powerful, again, in thinking about the Holocaust. It wasn't something that belonged to that other black and white world. It was something that took place in our world.
So you decide that you are going to go and see if you can find some of these people who are in the film. And the Holocaust Museum got involved?
Yeah, I donated the original footage to the Holocaust Museum as soon as I discovered it. I knew that it would take professional attention to rescue this footage if it even could be rescued. And I didn't have the knowledge or the resources to do that. But I knew that the Holocaust Museum was the place to go for that. So I donated the original footage and they worked with a film laboratory, Color Lab in Maryland, to restore the film. And at the same time, I started working with the researchers and the archivists there, because when I found the film, I didn't even know what town it was. The family story that had been handed down was that it showed my grandmother's hometown. And so I first, for 6 or 8 months, went on this sort of dead end in a way to try and find a survivor from my grandmother's hometown. And indeed, I did eventually find someone and I showed him the film. And within a second, he said, "It's not my town." He saw it immediately and knew that it was not his town, which was a big surprise to me. So I didn't even know which town it was when I found it. But I figured if it wasn't my grandmother's hometown, it was almost certainly my grandfather's hometown. And so I worked with the researchers at the Holocaust Museum to try and find someone or some documentation that could help confirm, first of all, where the film takes place.
And then a miracle happens. Literally a miracle. You get an email.
It's one of the most amazing things that's happened to me in my life. I searched for more than 2.5 years, and there had been 5 people who had given, you know, Shoah Foundation testimony. That's the Steven Spielberg video archive of Holocaust survivor testimony. 5 people who had given testimony from this town. And 4 of them had since passed away. And the one who was still living, I spoke with her and I interviewed her. But she was a small child when the war began. And she remained somehow still so traumatized by this experience that she wasn't even able to recognize her own town. She couldn't confirm that it was her town in the film. So I felt I was kind of at a dead end. I didn't know what to do. I found a fair amount of documentary evidence and papers and letters and things like that. But to go from faces in a film to names on a page, I just couldn't bridge that distance until one day, 2.5 years after I started researching this, I got an email kind of out of the blue, and a woman in Detroit I'd never heard of, I didn't know the name, wrote to me and said that she had seen the video of this film online at the Holocaust Museum's website. And as the camera panned across the crowd, there are all these children jumping and waving. And suddenly she recognized her grandfather as a 13-year-old boy, and he's still alive.
Her name is Marcy Rosen, and here's what Marcy had to say.
There is my grandfather's face. His smiling 14-year-old face. I would know it like I would know my own face in the mirror. But I've never seen a picture of my grandfather when he was 14 years old.
So when I received this email from Marcy, I, of course, immediately got on the phone with Maury Chandler, her grandfather. And the first thing that he said to me was, "You've given me back my childhood." And I think that that's a very common thing for survivors. The pre-war period is so overshadowed by the wartime experience that it almost doesn't register as a part of their own lives anymore. And for him now, suddenly to see himself as a boy before anything bad had happened in the context of his friends and his family and his town, it was for him like a revelation.
We're going to talk about him in a minute. Indulge me, though. I'm going to go off course for a second. Because
okay.
This crossed my mind as I was, A, reading the book, getting to know you, doing the research. Before we even get into all of what happened next, I want to talk to you about being Jewish and the Holocaust. You know, the saying goes, never forget, which is the commemorative political slogan that originated after the Holocaust. But for many Jews, particularly in the diaspora, now generations away from the Holocaust, great-grandparents, great-great-grandparents, names forgotten, right? Names never known. A native country that's nothing more than something in a history book. All these things are crossing my mind as I'm looking at this and reading this and listening to this. And I know that just prior to the war, my great-grandmother was living in the States, like your grandparents, went back to get some of her people out of Hungary. Never heard from her again. That was it. All gone. And that experience is what I want to talk to you about, because I'm actually looking at her right now as we're speaking in the office. A woman I didn't know, but I look at her and I see my face and it freaks me out.
Yeah.
Right? There's a blank in too many Jewish histories.
Sure. Well, one of the things when I found the film, I realized that it was representative of what they call pre-war Jewish life. And that's so vague and so general a description. I realized that, you know, film is this extraordinary medium. It always is specific. It captures a particular person in a particular place on a particular day. And unless we know who, where, and when, then it becomes this just kind of almost mythological general thing. Pre-war Jews, shtetl life. And I wanted, when I found the film, to see if I could learn what was happening in this moment, in this place, with these particular people. I wanted to learn information on the same scale of detail that the film had preserved in its images. And my family, my grandparents had moved to the U.S. I'm not the child of survivors. But seeing these images made me feel responsible for the identities of these people who just happened to stick their faces in my grandfather's camera lens on this particular day. And I realized that this was a record of people who would otherwise be anonymous, who would otherwise just be numbers or names on a list. And yet here we have a moment of their lives. And I really wanted to try and do honor to this very odd chance preservation of their faces and their gestures, their interactions with the other people in the town. And that was what motivated me.
There's another concept here, which is when I looked at it, and we both know that I'm Russian on one side, Hungarian another, you're Polish. Our concept of what a Jew is has absolutely no relation to that religious culture that shows up in that film.
Right. Well, you mentioned before this political slogan of never forget. And, you know, I went to Hebrew school in the 1970s. And, you know, in some ways, the Holocausts stood almost at the center of that religious education. We were Jewish because of the Holocaust, because others had tried to kill us. And I think it's in some ways a very perverse religious education. But I also thought about this question of, you know, we say never forget, but we don't necessarily say what we're supposed to remember. And if all we remember is that others tried to kill us, I think that we're failing. As cultural Jews, let alone as religious Jews, we're failing to recall the history, because what was destroyed was a 1,000-year history of Eastern European Jewry and of culture and of a language and of, you know, stories and gestures of physical culture, material culture. All of that was destroyed. And if all that we remember is some image of Auschwitz, which in any case is probably, you know, it's an inaccurate depiction of what truly happened. Only a small percentage of those who were killed in camps. So I think we fail as Jews to truly remember. And I think a better slogan, rather than never forget, would be always remember.
Yeah, which is why I had to bring that up to you. Like you, like me, like anybody who comes from that heritage, Marcy needed to grab onto something to understand something. Obviously, something was missing in the understanding of her grandfather, whose name, by the way, is Maurice Chandler. He was born Moshek, say his last name, Tuchhandler.
Moshek Tuchhandler.
I love that. Tuchhandler, who is now what?
He's 90 years old. He just turned 90.
Years old. And very important thing came out in what you wrote, and that is how he tells his story is based on a lot of things. One time. And time and memory, that changes things. Yeah. Two, I think you mentioned people look to see how we're going to react to what they have to say and perhaps couch what they're going to tell us within that framework. Do you know what I'm getting to here?
Sure, I do. You know, I had the privilege of talking with Maury and interviewing him over the course of several years. It's now more than 3 years since we first met, and we still talk pretty frequently. And certainly in the course of this research, we spoke very often. And so I had the opportunity, you know, first I had to get to know him and get to know the stories that are in his repertoire, the things that he would tell his family or tell others when they asked him about his history. But I also then over time, and as I learned more about this town of Nashelsk, and I met other people who could tell me other aspects of its life, I was able to begin to try and get behind the kind of practiced stories that people tell. And one of the remarkable things for me about my interaction with Maury was that the more I learned and the more specifically I would question him, the more he was able to remember. He has a truly extraordinary memory. And I would discover these documents, like, for example, the 1929 Business Directory of Nashelsk, has the name of a couple of hundred people who ran businesses. And yeah, even if he hadn't remembered someone's name beforehand, when we went through this directory, he would suddenly remember something. And because of the violence and the thoroughness with which this culture was destroyed, in this town in particular, even to remember, oh, you know, he had a big beard and he carried a cane and the kids were afraid of him, even remembering that seems somehow important. It's some personal detail that makes a number into a person.
Here's the voice of Marcy Rosen's grandfather, Maury.
I can't believe that I was really yet a kid. My God, I had a mother, and I had a grandmother, and people were getting married and bringing forth generation after generation. It's looking back and saying, yes, there was a world.
There's one other thing that I want to talk about, and that's how Maurice survived the war, because I think that's extraordinary, too, what he had to do.
Yeah. Well, you know, nobody who survived, survived in a boring way. And I think that, as you say, as time goes by and, you know, we become familiar with these stories, you know, people say, oh, well, he survived in hiding. And it's as if that explains something. And we think, oh, right, he survived in hiding. And we don't think more about it. But to understand really on kind of a day-to-day level, what that meant and what that meant psychologically and emotionally and physically is just incredible. And that was one of the things I tried to do with Maury. First, because he has such a remarkable memory. And second, because he was able to preserve a lot of documentation So the short story is he escaped from the Warsaw Ghetto in May of 1941 and ended up working on a farm about 65 kilometers east of Warsaw. And at that time, it was possible for Jews still to live in the countryside under their own names as Jews. So he worked on the farm of a Polish woman and stayed there for almost 9 months. And then the order came down that all Jews had to congregate in ghettos. They had to be in ghettos. This was in preparation for Operation Reinhardt, which was the first most sort of lethal wave of killing. And the night before he was supposed to go into the ghetto, the woman that he was working for asked him, well, what are you going to do? And he said, well, I don't seem to have any choice. I guess I'll go to a ghetto. And she said, we're not going to a ghetto. And her nephew worked at the County Hall of Records, and he was able to steal a birth certificate of a Polish boy who had died. And they gave Maury this birth certificate, and they taught him how to pray, how to, you know, do the catechism, and said, go, try and be this person. And so from the late summer of 1942 until the beginning of 1945, he lived in disguise with this birth certificate as a Polish boy. And he wandered farther into the countryside. He hired himself out as a farmhand, as a laborer. And yeah, he was able to pass. And I mean, think about that. Every single day, if they hear the slightest trace of a Jewish accent in your Polish, if, you know, the ways in which he could trip himself up were so mundane. He was with a family and they gave him the bread to cut. And, you know, he cuts it the way his family would cut challah on Sabbath, you know, very daintily with the knife. And they look at him like he's from Mars. And the woman of the house said to him, if I didn't know any better, I'd say you were a Jew. And he said, well, why do you say that? She says, well, the way you're cutting bread, you know, that's not the way we do it here in the country. And she showed him how they did it. So, you know, the simplest things that you would never even imagine could become dangerous, lethal dangers, because the moment your identity is questioned, you know, it's over. There's a test that no Jewish boy could survive, and you had to prevent that from happening.
You were actually able to locate six more survivors. I just want to talk to you briefly about Fischl Perlmutter.
Right. Well, so the seven survivors altogether, including Maury, yeah, they were spread out all over the world, really. And these are the people who just happened to live the longest. You know, I didn't start searching until 2009. I didn't meet Maury until the end of 2011. And so all of them were in their 80s and 90s. And all of them, therefore, had kind of childhood images of this town. But one of the things that was so extraordinary about this story and that was so unexpected to me was that the memories of the survivors would begin to intersect. And each of them, even if they hadn't really known each other as kids, or if they hadn't been in touch, or, you know, didn't really even know anything about each other, still, they often held pieces of each other's family histories. They would remember an older brother or sister or some incident that both of them were able to recall. And one of the figures whom almost everybody remembered was Fischl Perlmutter. And Fischl Perlmutter was the town photographer. He was someone that almost everyone in the town, even the non-Jews, knew of because he was so talented, and he was the person, if you needed a family portrait or if there was a special occasion, he was the person that you went to. So even when I was back in Meshelsk and talked to the residents there, they remembered Fischl Perlmutter as well. In addition, he was a very, very talented artist. And apparently sometime in the early 30s, he painted these murals on the walls of the synagogue. And they were apparently masterpieces. Everyone who remembered it, one of the first things that they would say was it was a very large synagogue, and it had these exquisite murals, which had been painted by Fischl Perlmutter.
So Glenn, here we are, all these many years since you started on this journey of yours. Unbelievable. Unbelievable.
Thank you.
You've walked through, in some senses, the fires of the Holocaust yourself.
Well, you know, I'm always cautious about over-identifying or sort of usurping the experience of the people that I spoke with who really did survive it. I, much as I've engaged with it, as much time as I've spent with people who lived it, I really don't feel that I can say that I know what it was like. But that urgency to try and understand was one of the things that motivated me, and really to get as close as possible to what that day-to-day experience was like was what I aimed to do.
My point is this. I believe that what happened altered the DNA of every Jew who's ever walked the face of the earth. I believe that. I believe that when you kill one Jew, in one way or another, you kill us all. And in that sense, I think you were able to walk through their fire, if you will, if metaphorically only.
Yeah.
And it's an anointing. So thank you.
Well, thank you. I feel privileged to have had the opportunity and to be in this position to give back to these people who lost everything, even some small piece of their histories, and especially a piece of their histories from before the Holocaust. And yeah, to have been able to provide someone with a photograph of their father, and they didn't have anymore a photograph of their father, and they hadn't seen his face since 1939, to give back these little pieces felt like something of a great, great privilege.
76 years ago, German troops assembled the town of Niszelk, Poland's Jews, at gunpoint, in the square, chopping off people's beards and hair for entertainment. Then they crammed them into a synagogue overnight, where they made them scrape off official perlmutters, biblical murals, with their fingernails. Afterward, Jews were forced to run through thick mud while being whipped. Germans then stripped and frisked young women, many raped 2 days prior, before loading everyone onto sealed trains to ghettos over 100 miles away, from which they were later deported to their murders. But thanks to Glenn Kurtz's grandfather David, captured on film, which will live forever, is the beauty, the joy, the hearts, the very spirits of the Jewish people from the Polish shtetl. That spirit Hitler and the Nazis could not annihilate. I've been speaking to Glenn Kurtz, author of 3 Minutes in Poland, Discovering a Lost World in a 1938 Family Film by way of Farah, Strauss, and Giroux. For more about the book, the work of Glenn Kurtz, and to view the film 3 Minutes in Poland, visit glennkurtz.com. Every once in a while, a very special film enters our cultural lexicon, such as the film Above and Beyond, the birth of the Israeli Air Force, produced by accomplished businesswoman, fundraiser, and philanthropist Nancy Spielberg, who thankfully for us all has recently turned her attention to producing documentary films, and directed by award-winning filmmaker Roberta Grossman, who has produced more than 40 hours of documentary film and television, including Hava Nagila and Blessed is the Match, which was shortlisted for an Academy Award. Above and Beyond tells the moving and powerful story of a group of World War II pilots, mostly Americans, who risked their life and limb to volunteer to fight for Israel in the 1948 War of Independence, a war fought in the nasty wake of the Holocaust, when 6 million Jews' lives were lost in Hitler's gas chambers, the survivors left without a home or a place to go, except Palestine. As members of Machal, volunteers from abroad, this ragtag band of brothers not only turned the tide of the war, preventing the possible annihilation of the embryo nation at the very moment of its birth, they also laid the groundwork for the Israeli Air Force, bringing together emotional interviews, stunning aerial footage, archival material, and a soundtrack by the great Hans Zimmer Studio. The story of the aviators is a story of heroism and high-flying chutzpah told by the very flyboys and others who were there. Let's talk. So Nancy, Roberta, thank you so much for this really extraordinarily powerful and moving film. I watched it last night, and truthfully, I have to tell you, the faces of the men, they just spoke to me. They're in my head. I never slept last night. I get up and I have to prepare for this. So thank you. Just gorgeous, gorgeous film. I mean, wow. So Nancy, let me start with you. There are 1,000 stories to be told. How did you hear of this one? And why was this the one that you chose to tell?
I'm trying to figure that out still. actually, somebody, and I don't remember who, sent me an email and said, this should be your next movie. And, you know, and I sort of get a lot of that. Usually it's not, this should be your next movie, but please give this to your brother so it'll be his next movie. And this one, you know, I was just about to click, you know, trash, and then I read it, and it was an obituary titled Father of the Israeli Air Force Dies at 94, and I really expected to describe some Israeli, Yossi so-and-so, and instead it went on to describe an American and how he was a TWA flight engineer, Al Schwimmer, how he smuggled airplanes planes into Israel in 1948 when the British were pulling out, when Israel was voted into statehood and was attacked by all the surrounding armies and had no way to defend itself. And when it went on to describe how he smuggled the airplanes out of the U.S. and recruited his buddies and the FBI was chasing him and he was indicted, it just sounded like this incredible adventure film. And I don't know, I just said, this is mine. This has my name all over it. And I just ran with that.
Well, if the truth is in the finished product, yes, it has your name all over it. Like I said, brilliant. Roberta, how did you and Nancy come together on this project?
An email in my inbox that had the word Spielberg in who it was from. And I thought somebody was playing a trick on me. And because I have this running gag in my whole life that when the phone rings, I often will say, if it, you know, Steven, tell him I'm not available. So here was an email in my inbox from Spielberg. And I saw it was from Nancy Spielberg. She was interested in talking to me about a project. And I did a little bit of inquiry with people who would know, found out that Steven did indeed have a sister named Nancy. And we began to talk. And we're still talking 2 years later.
Right, which is great. That's a miracle for some filmmakers, right?
Right, I love it. Two filmmakers. Listen, the other thing is, so from the time you all started till now, 2 years?
Well,
to
I
birth
guess it's been, by, at this point, it's been about 3 years, right, Nancy? I mean,
well, the film was done in May of 2014. So, you know, it just started in film festivals in the summer. It was about 2 years, though, in the making, really. It was, you know, from start to finish. You know, I read the obituary in the fall of 2011. We started filming 2012 and raising money. So, we did it quickly for many reasons. First of all, Roberta looked at me and said, there is no time to waste. We have to get these interviews immediately because every day somebody was gone. And then we wanted the film to be out there so that the guys could have their moment to shine, you know, to really enjoy that they did.
Well, then this is interesting to me. You and your brother, Steven Spielberg, in case anybody had any doubts that they knew who we were talking about, you guys have worked tirelessly to tell the stories that have risen out of the ashes of the Holocaust. And where'd that passion come from? How did you all get on this?
You know, again, that's sort of funny. You would think that we were, you know, children of survivors, and we were not. We grew up in Arizona in a very non-Jewish neighborhood, and I don't think I really knew anything about the Holocaust growing up, not until later years. My brother was exposed to it because my grandmother had taught survivors English back in Cincinnati, where he was born. So he had seen the tattoos, and it had made an impression on him one way or another. So I think that was ingrained in him. But I also think he himself didn't really get it until he was over there filming. You know, for 10 years, he tried not to do Schindler's List. I think he asked Scorsese to take it, and I think he felt it was too big a responsibility. But being on that hallowed ground changed his life. And I think Schindler's List changed all of us in many ways. I think we realize even more so how visual histories are probably the only way to teach the next generation. You know, they do not want to read black and white. They don't want to read anything longer than a tweet. But when you see these people tell their story, it's so powerful. And I think that's what drove me also to doing this, was realizing that my brother did, you know, he did something great. We all know that. And we can learn by it, by gathering these other stories and preserving them, preserving our legacy, our history.
Absolutely. Roberta, same question put a different way. When so many Jews have assimilated in the diaspora, you seem committed to telling the Jewish story. This isn't your first foray into telling a tale of those times.
So what is the question?
why tell these stories for you?
I am a glutton for punishment, apparently. I am endlessly fascinated by history. That is my passion in life. And I am even more fascinated in Jewish history and in telling the Jewish story. It's just something that it takes a lot to make a documentary. It takes a lot to make a historical documentary. It takes a lot of time. It takes a lot of energy. It takes a lot of effort to raise the money, to do a good job in telling the story. And it takes, usually, when you don't have Nancy running behind you with a whip, it usually takes 3 or 4 years to make a film like this. And so you better be really, really, really passionate about it. And I find that my passion button gets pushed very often by stories of Jewish history.
Nancy, this story, I've told a bit of it in the introduction, but give us some details. How did these men get involved in the Israeli war effort? And how do they get the planes? I mean, it's a lot to tell. And how did Czechoslovakia get involved? I mean, have at it, darling. we got 25 minutes.
So it all started. Actually, most of these guys, they came back from World War II. You know, a lot of them were celebrated heroes. And we focused on the pilots. These are American pilots. They came back. They're sort of like swashbuckly types, you know, with their leather bomber jacket. And fitting back into a normal routine in life was a little tough for them. Many of them found that they couldn't even get jobs. The commercial airlines would not hire Jewish pilots. And for various reasons, they found themselves drawn to helping, you know, what was going to become Israel. Everybody knew there was going to be a war. There was going to be a land grab. The British were pulling out and all the Arab countries were going to attack and divide Israel amongst themselves. And everybody knew Israel was not allowed to arm itself under British rule. So some of these guys actually responded because they had just come back from World War II, liberating the camps. They see survivors coming into Israel and walking into what looks like another potential genocide. So some of them felt it was their duty, and they seeked out people to, how can I help? Other ones were called by their buddies, you know, hey, I'm doing this for Israel and you should come. And others were literally found on lists with, you know, there are people that scoured lists of Jewish-sounding names that had pilot status, and calling them and saying, would you be interested in flying for Israel? And so they sort of found their way into this Haganah, this sort of secret operative in the United States, where weapons and money and pilots were all being amassed and snuck out of the country. And then they created fake airlines. I mean, how do you smuggle a plane out? It's not something that's, you know, in your pocket. They created fake airlines, and they smuggled planes to Panama and hopscotched them to Czechoslovakia. And why Czechoslovakia? The Czechs were the only country that would sell Israel fighter planes. And they also allowed all the planes that were being smuggled out to land and sort of have a base in Czechoslovakia to prepare while the British were still in Palestine. They were ready to leave. So they trained the Americans how to fly these planes. And the Czechs sold Israel. Czechoslovakia made Messerschmitt, which were the German planes that these guys tried so hard to shoot down in World War II. All of a sudden, they're behind, you know, they're behind the wheel or the joystick flying these German planes. And so they had to learn how to fly them. And that's sort of how the Czechs got involved. The Czechs were very supportive of Israel, and they needed the money. And they connected with Israel's struggle for independence, because the Czechs were under German occupation, and the Russians were there. So all those factors together sort of brought this, like, it was sort of like an air base in Czechoslovakia, training, prepping, until they could fly into Israel.
It's a phenomenal story. I mean, even, you know, flying these, single-engine planes, you know, over the Atlantic, like Charles Lindbergh. I mean, there was the last person to do that. Fascinating. And the footage, but we're going to talk about that in a minute. Roberta, you worked with these guys who were willing to talk. They're not actors. You're a director. How'd you direct them?
I'm a documentary filmmaker, and so I do interviews. I mean, of course, I work with actors as well when we do recreations, but it's not a matter of directing people like this. It's a matter of listening to them and asking questions that will evoke interesting responses and asking them again and again until they actually have an interesting response. But in this case, all we really had to do was say hello and then sit back, because these guys were very, very happy to tell their stories. And, you know, you have to remember that what they did was illegal. They were breaking the law by going and fighting for a foreign country. And when they came back, they, you know, when you've done something illegal, when do you stop looking over your shoulder? I mean, is it a year? Is it 2 years? Is it 5 years? So one of the reasons that we've never heard this story before is because the guys didn't talk about it, because what they had done was illegal. So, you know, now they're in their 90s, late 80s, 90s, and they're clearly not going to be arrested. And there was an opportunity to really sit down and tell their story, and they were only too happy to do so, because this was, as all of them say across the board, this was the most important thing they did in their lives. And I think it may have been, even though it was a war, it may have been, you know, it was the most, it was definitely the most meaningful thing they all said they did in their lives, and it may even have been the most fun they ever had.
Yeah, right, exactly. I think there's another interesting aspect of this that people may not know, which is that although the president at the time, Truman, was very much for an Israeli state, there was a lot of problems with the State Department not wanting our people or any American to get involved in this. So, right. Nancy, right?
Yes. Well, my understanding from the historians that we spoke to was that the British put a lot of pressure on the United States to just stay out of it. And that was their way to stay out of it, because that embargo was against the combatant parties of the Middle East. So it really wasn't necessarily just against Israel. It was against sending any war materials over there. But it really only hurt Israel, because the British had supplied the Egyptians with, you know, they left them their everything, and they sold them planes as well. So, and the Jordanians were very well equipped. So the only one that really got hurt was the guy that started with nothing. And so that nothing meant that they had to be creative and really quick thinking to get what they can in any way that they could.
Another thing that I found interesting was they were all raised in the States, most of them. They weren't all Jewish, by the way, we should make that point, but some of the key guys were. But they were raised in the United States at a time when anti-Semitism was very powerful and very strong. They'd all had suffered incidences of anti-Semitism, and yet none of them felt particularly Jewish as part of what the diaspora, I suspect. That, of course, after World War II, that had a huge effect on why some of these guys decided to go, right?
Right, right. I mean, they say that Al Schwimmer's entire motivation was that he was flying transport during the war, and that he saw a newsreel about the camp, and it just infuriated him so much that he just felt compelled to do something. And he's the one that said to Ben-Gurion, you don't have an Air Force, you don't have a shot in hell to win this war. And nobody thought that Israel would win. You know, the British didn't think Israel would win. They just thought, everybody thought it would be over in 2 weeks because they were so outnumbered and, you know, outpowered. So it's interesting because that anti-Semitism did not push them towards their Jewishness. You're right. Though it definitely made them understand that they were different because of what they endured from getting beat up, going to school, or not being able to get jobs. But it wasn't their Jewishness that sent them there. Like you said, there were 20% of all the volunteers that went to Israel in 48 to volunteer ground, land, and water. 20% were not Jewish.
Right. So fascinating. You know, there's a wonderful quote, and there are a lot of wonderful quotes that these guys were just wonderful to listen to. This one was, I can't remember which one who said it, by the way, but it was that the idea that Jews were going to fight and it was about time.
That was Harold Livingston.
Didn't that rock you? When he said that, that just rocked me. And I was curious as to from both of you, was what some of the things you heard or learned that so surprised you. Roberta, what about you?
Well, I have very mixed feelings about that statement that Harold made. because that's his perspective. But as we've come to know, there were a lot of Jews who fought and fought back during the Holocaust, even under the most extreme conditions. Some fought back with Molotov cocktails and guns. Some fought back just by finding a way to educate and feed their children in a ghetto. There were, you know, uprisings at Sobibor and at Treblinka. And then there were about 1 million Jewish people from all over the world who fought in World War II, and in particular in the Jewish Brigade. So I think that was his perspective, and that's kind of an old stereotype of Jews. So I have sort of mixed feelings about that. But yes, Israel coming into being and the image of the strong, young, fighting Israelis certainly was a very different image than the shtetl Jew. But of course, the shtetl Jew was in great decline in Europe even before the war. So that's my two cents about that.
Nancy, your most one moment that somebody said something that just struck you that you weren't expecting?
Oh, my. Well, I think that was a strong moment. I think I understood where Harold was coming from, and I have a little bit different from, I mean, Roberta is much more well-versed in what, you know, the whole topic of Holocaust and what went on, because that's her light reading.
True, right.
But I sort of thought that we were trying to really fight or kill that image of the victim. That was the image that we needed to squash, because that was the image that was portrayed. Jews being the image of the bookish pawnbroker, wimpy kind of guy, you know, was out there. And, you know, here these guys had anti-Semitism where they got beat up and then saw what happened in the war, couldn't come back and get jobs because Jews don't fly and, you know, aren't capable, whatever it was. So in a sense, to me, it wasn't fighting necessarily physically as much as it was fighting also really that whole image, changing the image that we're not the wimpy tribe that you can pick, you know, because there was a lot of picking on. There were so many moments. I think I was really blown away by the guys' emotions about their mothers and fathers. I didn't expect that. You know, I expected some of the machismo and bravery and, you know, sort of, well, that was my duty and I did my duty kind of matter-of-fact discussion. I didn't expect the soft underside. And I think that was wonderful. I didn't expect the tears. The guys, you know, a few of them really got very teary-eyed talking about trying to get their father's approval or hurting their mom. And I loved that. I loved seeing amongst the craggy face, you know, you could see those young eyes come out.
You're reading my mind, because I was just going to say that to you, I swear. I was going with the fact that these guys, that they were boys when this happened, number one. And they were testosterone-fueled, swaggering daredevils. And And one of the great delights of the film was that despite the creases in their face and despite the gray hair or the lack thereof, these guys still had that youth and vim and vigor and sparkle in their eyes when they talked about this. I think maybe that's what killed me. I don't know. Yeah. I mean, right? I could cry about that right now. It was so moving to watch, right?
You know what's funny? That's exactly how I want to grow up.
Me too.
Not that
me
I
too.
Want to be a dirty old man, but I just want to always, I just want to hold on to all the wonderful youth and in a good way. You know, I think that's what keeps us all perky. And
you've got a mother and I got a mother who are a testament to get up there and just go, baby, just go, go, go. This fascinated me. Paul Reubens, Pee Wee Herman to most people, father, Milt Rubenfeld, was a pilot who flew in the Royal Air Force and U.S. Army during World War II. That when you introduced him, that too was extraordinary. What a juxtaposition, right?
I know. Who knew that someday you'd see Pee Wee saying gefilte fish, matzah, Pesach?
Right? It's
all
true, and that's a great story.
I really think all of Paul's fans on his Twitter are like, huh? What?
Yeah, no, that blew me away too, because that scene, his father, and let me tell it quickly and then you can take over, his father had to crash or make an emergency landing, and he's like the enemy, if you will, and then he finally comes across some Jews, except he doesn't speak Hebrew, so he tries to explain that he really is, you know, a good guy, and he screams to fish. That is so funny. I mean, that was amazing. Did you know that about his father going into this?
Well, the first guy that told us that story, I actually met with Shimon Peres in December of 2011 because I knew he had been close with Al Schwimmer. And a friend of mine said, you know, I can set you up to talk to him. He can tell you a lot. And I was in the research mode. And he's the one who said, did you hear the gefilte fish story? But he didn't say Pee Wee, you know, Paul Reubens, Pee Wee Herman. He just said he has a famous son. So then I Googled it and we found out, and, you know, Roberta and I discussed it when we talked to Paul. And it was the most caring, loving son, because he really took care of his father until his father passed away. He was really just a wonderful, warm person. We said, you know, this could be really good. And then all the guys told us the gefilte fish story. They, you know, it was that story, and there was a story about one of the non-Jews that's very funny. That was, I think it's in the iTunes extras. Wait, is it, Roberta? I'm not sure if it is, but it will be. It'll be an extra. One of the non-Jews, a guy named Trig Messing, was volunteered, and he was a fighter pilot, and he fell in love with a Jewish girl, so he converted, and he married her. And the big joke that these guys told us is that on base he had to have a circumcision, and when they cut him, because you have to draw blood, he screamed out Jesus Christ, which was like totally inappropriate at a bris. And so, you know, everybody got a big chuckle. So we heard a couple of stories a few times over, you know, about gefilte fish and about the bris on the base in Ramat David. So you know, it was funny, some surprises.
And I think people will be gloriously surprised when they see this film, because it is filled with so many just things you just don't expect. You just don't expect. Roberta, putting this thing together, did you have a vision when you first took it on and have to watch that change and alter, or did you just open yourself up to let's just see what happens and we'll see how we're going to put this together?
I think what I had was complete and total panic.
That's not true. Well, you hit it well.
No, I mean, you know, as I told Nancy, you know, I was afraid that the subtitle of the film was going to be Old Guys Talking. And you know what? We could have that as the subtitle of the film now, because these old guys tell great stories and they're great old guys. So their talking is what makes the film really enjoyable, I think. You know, when you tell a historical story, you already know the beginning, middle, and the end. But everything in between and all the details and how you tell that story is all up for grab. And it was a process. It's not certainly... Nancy had the vision to tell the story. And then Nancy and myself, the writer Sophie Sartain and the editor Chris Kouster, the four of us really had to sweat blood and bullets to figure out over the course of 2 years how to structure the story, how to tell the story, because you have to tell enough about the formation of the State of Israel to make that understandable. You have to know enough about geopolitics to understand the part that Britain played and the embargo. You have to know about what the American response was. You have to know enough about the lives of each individual pilot to care about whether they live and die in this war. So there's a lot going on, and I can consider it to be a minor miracle that we were able to, I think, successfully balance all those elements in a very pithy 83 minutes.
Well, I'm here to tell you that you absolutely 100%, no question about it, did. And what's so fabulous about this is, besides these marvelous interviews with these just extraordinary men, the footage that you use, going back into the archives and finding Ben-Gurion, finding Golda Meir, and pictures of the Copacabana.
I love that.
So seeing the men in their youth and seeing all of that, talk to me about how emotional it was for both of you. You first, Nancy.
Incredibly emotional to me. I'm very teary-eyed, and I still get teary-eyed at the film, but watching them watch themselves and watching their children and their grandchildren understand for once what it is that dad and grandpa did in the war. You know, they heard it, but seeing it in the big context, it's a major group hug where there's a lot of tears and a lot of gratitude. We are so grateful for what they shared with us, and they are grateful for having finally have their story out there and told. It's just really been quite a journey for all of us, and we're still on the journey. Audiences respond so emotionally and uplifting. You know, it's just wonderful.
And that's the thing, it is uplifting. Although, certainly it's a story about bravery, heroes, courage, commitment, sacrifice. It has it all. It isn't all pretty, and let's not say that it is. There is one story about one of the pilots who actually left part of the time. That would happen for fatigue, whatever. And there was PTSD, a story that I thought I don't remember his name, you'll forgive me, but
yeah,
he was so filled with candor about it. And I love that. I love that. And I love the fact that you guys addressed that in the film. So it was a very balanced telling. I have to ask you one thing. In the credits, one of the people was you. A special thanks to Kirk Douglas. Why was that?
Well, first of all, Kirk, besides the fact he did give us some money for the film. And why did he give us money? Because Kirk played Mickey Marcus in Cast a Giant Shadow. And that film with Frank Sinatra, who was a bomb chucker throwing seltzer bottles out of airplanes, what our guys also did, Mickey Marcus was a volunteer. He was a Mahalnik from the ground forces. And so Kirk got it. Kirk, that whole experience for Kirk of being in Israel and filming Cast a Giant Shadow stayed with him all of his life. You know, he still speaks the same Hebrew speech he learned when he was over there. And anytime I mentioned this story to anybody, they went, "Is that like Cast a Giant Shadow?" So that's the only connection people could make if they'd heard any inkling of this. It was, I think I remember something about a movie that happened to star Kirk Douglas. So Kirk wanted to be supportive of the film, and he was. And that's really, you know, it was wonderful to have him there.
Right, and have him still around to tell the story of that. That was a great film that a lot of people didn't see, of our generation who need to see it, because it's really it's as good as Exodus in its own way. These are tough times for Israel. The heroes and heroines have fought so valiantly for a homeland for the Jewish people are being portrayed not only by Arabs, but even by some Jews, not as freedom fighters, but as terrorists. So on too many college campuses today, Israel is the country students love to hate. I'm sure you both are aware of that. The country that was once celebrated as a miracle, which in 48 defeated, listen to me, 5 Arab armies, amazing, is now often maligned. So in watching Above and Beyond, one is gently kind of nudged to remember what is too easy to forget. We are where we are today to a large degree because of that UN vote for partition and the Arabs' refusal to accept it. So I'd like to hear both of your thoughts on the political message this film, unwittingly or not, portrays. Roberta?
I'm thinking.
Think away, darling. We got all week at time.
You know, it's really been very gratifying. Nancy has gone to more places, many more places with the film than I have. She's really the ambassador with the film. The few places that I've gone to, it's very moving to see how moved people are, especially people, older people who remember very well how they felt about Israel when the state was formed and how what Israel has meant to the Jewish people. And it's not so easy to stand up in the middle of the public square anymore and say, you know, I love Israel, I'm a Zionist, or even to make that a nuanced statement that I don't agree with everything Israel does, but I believe that Israel has the right to exist and I support it. Even to make such a nuanced statement, it can be difficult in the public square these days. So it's really very moving to watch the film and to do Q&A with audiences afterwards, because people are so moved by just an outright expression of support for Israel or remembering what those early days were like and what Israel meant to Jews all over the world.
Nancy?
Well, you know, I think that, and you're very smart the way that you had phrased that, because, you know, we kept saying, this is not a political film. This is a story about the guys. The background is this. But there were things that just come out at you. There was a two-state solution on the table. It was accepted by the Jews. And you've got to think about that. And if I make any point, it's, you know, try to look at Israel with fresh eyes, because there's so much
Israel bashing that is not, you know, it's not accurate. We all have complaints about every country. America, it's not necessarily love it or leave it. We have a right to voice our complaints about any country we love, and I feel like I belong to two countries. But Israel has a right to defend itself if it's attacked, and I sort of just wanted that out there, you know, quietly, but I wanted that out there. I think it was important because it's scary what's going on. And I think there's very little difference between anti-Israel and anti-Semitic. I think that those lines have so blurred that I personally feel unsafe. And I never felt that way before. I wouldn't go to certain cities in Europe right now. I wouldn't feel comfortable. I almost feel like that because a lot of the bashing that's going on is not necessarily done with smart dialogue. There's just mantras being repeated without thought or knowledge. So, you know, maybe people can stop and listen and have dialogue again. You know, I don't know. I'm going to ask for the world and I don't have the answers, but we had to throw that out there. We had to throw it out there. There was a two-state solution on the table back then. That was the fact.
Right. The facts. And I think that's why this film is so important. So let me finish on saying, because I don't normally on air applaud, but I have to on this because it's that brilliant a piece. Wow. And more importantly, it's that important a piece at a time that we needed to have something like that out there. So ladies, thank you both.
Thank you very much.
Thank you so much. We're glad you applauded on air.
I've been speaking with the producer of the extraordinary documentary, Above and Beyond, The Birth of the Israeli Air Force, Nancy Spielberg, and award-winning director, Roberta Grossman. For more information about the film, be sure to visit aboveandbeyondthemovie.com and playmountproductions.com. Before I go, I want to remind everyone that podcasts of current and past shows are always available to listen to free on iTunes under The Hallie Kasser-Jane Show. The Hallie Kasser-Jane Show is also available for download via Spreaker.com, Stitcher.com, BlogTalkRadio.com, and a host of other venues. Google The Hallie Kasser-Jane Show, and you will find us. Of course, podcasts of our shows, both past and present, are always posted for your listening pleasure at HallieKasserJane.com. I'll be back next week, same time, 3 p.m. Eastern, for another edition of The Hallie Kasser-Jane Show, brought to you by Audible.com. Get a free audiobook download at www.audibletrial.com/The Hallie Kasser-Jane Show. Stay in touch, won't you? Remember, that's HallieKasserJane.com. Discover us on Facebook at Hallie Kasser-Jane and on Twitter at HallieCJ. I love to hear from you. So, till we meet again, this is Hallie Kasser-Jane. It's a wrap.